a wanton woman. As a teenage girl, hair shooting from her ponytail like fireworks, she was the definition of nice-looking, the kind of person who reminds you of a neighbor or an old babysitter you always liked. By her 20s, with one or two or four kids clamoring up her, the smile was bigger but hassled, and she was always leaning away from one of us. I picture her as constantly under siege by her children, the sheer weight of us. By her 30s, there weren't many photos of her at all. In the few that exist, she's smiling in an obedient fashion, one of those take-the-dang-photo smiles that will disappear with the camera flash. I haven't looked at the photos in years. I used to paw at them obsessively, studying her clothes, her expression, whatever was in the background, looking for clues. Whose hand is that on her shoulder? Where is she? What occasion is it? When I was still a teenager, I sealed them away, along with everything else. Now I stood looking at the boxes as they slouched under my staircase, apologetic. I was gearing up to reacquaint myself with my family. I'd brought Michelle's note to the Kill Club because I couldn't bear to actually open those boxes. Instead, I'd reached into one cardboard corner where the tape was loose, and that's the first thing I pulled out, a pathetic carnival game. If I was really going to take this on, if I was really going to think about the murders after all these careful years spent doing just the opposite, I needed to be able to look at basic household possessions without panicking. Our old metal egg beater that sounded like sleigh bells when you turned it fast enough. Bent knives and forks that had been inside my family's mouths. A coloring book or two with defined crayoned borders, if it was Michelle's. Bored horizontal scrawls, if it was mine. Look at them. Let them just be objects. Then decide what to sell. To the kill creeps, the most desired items from the day home are unavailable. The 10-gauge shotgun that killed my mom, her goose gun, is snug away in some evidence drawer, along with the axe from our tool shed. That was another reason Ben got convicted. Those weapons were from our house. Outside killers don't arrive at a sleeping home with limp hands, just hoping to find convenient murder weapons. Sometimes I tried to picture all that stuff. The axe, the gun, the bedsheets Michelle died on. Were all those bloody, smoky, sticky objects all together, conspiring in some big box? Had they been cleaned? If you opened the box, what would the smell be like? I remembered that close, rot earth smell. Just hours after the murder. Was it worse now, after so many years of decay? I'd once been to Chicago, seen Lincoln's death artifacts in a museum. Thatches of his hair, bullet fragments, the skinny spindle bed he'd died on, the mattress still slouched in the middle, like it knew to preserve his last imprint. I ended up running to the bathroom, pressing my face against the cold stall door to keep from swooning. What would the day death house look like if we reunited all its relics, and who would come to see it? How many bundles of my mother's blood-stuck hair would be in the display cabinet? What happened to the walls, smeared with those hateful words when our house was torn down? Could we gather a bouquet of frozen reeds where I'd crouched for so many hours? Or exhibit the end of my frostbitten finger? My three gone toes? I turned away from the boxes, not up to the challenge, and sat down at a desk that served as my dining room table. The mail had brought me a package of random, crazy person offerings from Barb Eichel. A videotape, circa 1984, titled Threat to Innocence, Satanism in America. A paper-clipped packet of newspaper stories about the murders. A few Polaroids of Barb standing outside the courthouse where Ben's trial was being held. a dog-eared manual entitled Your Prison Family, Get Past the Bars. I removed the paperclip from the packet and put it in my paperclip cup in the kitchen. No one should ever buy paperclips, pens, any of those free-range office supplies. Then I popped the videotape into my very old VHS player. Click, whirr, groan. Images of pentagrams and goat men, of screaming rock bands and dead people flashed on the screen. A man with a beautiful hairsprayed mullet was walking along a graffitied wall, explaining that this video will help you identify Satanists and even watch for signs that those you love most may be flirting with this very real danger. He interviewed preachers, cops, and some actual Satanists. The two most powerful Satanists had tire-streak eyeliner and black robes and pentagrams around their necks, but they were sitting in their living room on a cheap velveteen couch, and you could just see into the kitchen on the right where a yellow refrigerator hummed on a cheery linoleum floor. I could picture them after the interview rummaging through the fridge for tuna salad and a Coke, their capes getting in the way. I turned off the video right about when the host was warning parents to scour their children's rooms for He-Man action figures and Ouija boards. The clippings were just as useless, and I had no idea what Barb wanted me to do with the photos of her. I sat defeated and lazy. I could have gone to the library to look things up properly. I could have set myself up with home internet access 3 years ago when I said I would. Neither seems like an option right now. I was easily wearied. So I phoned Lyle. He picked up on the first ring. "Hey, Libby," he said. "I was going to call you. I mean, I really wanted to apologize for last week. You must have felt ganged up on, and that wasn't what was supposed to happen."
Nice speech.
"Yeah, it really sucked. I guess I didn't realize that all of us had our own theories, but none of them included Ben being guilty. I didn't think it through, and I didn't realize. I didn't take into account just, you know, this is real to you. I mean, I know that, we know that. But we don't at the same time. We really just never will, I don't think. Totally get that. You spend so much time discussing and debating, it becomes... But, well, I'm sorry."
I didn't want to like Lyle Worth, as I'd already decided he was a prick. But I appreciate a straightforward apology the way a tone-deaf person enjoys a fine piece of music. I can't do it, but I can applaud it in others.
"Well," I said, "there are definitely members who'd still like to acquire any, you know, mementos you want to sell, if that's why you're calling."
"Oh, no, I just wondered. I have been thinking a lot about the case." I might as well have said dot, dot, dot aloud. We met at a bar not far away from me, a place called Sarah's, which always struck me as a weird name for a bar, but it was a mellow enough place, with a good amount of room. I don't like people up on me. Lyle was already seated, but he stood up as I came in and bent down to hug me, the action causing much twisting and collapsing of his tall body. The side of his glasses poked my cheek. He was wearing another 80s-style jacket, this one denim, covered with slogan buttons. "Don't drink and drive. Practice random kindness. Rock the vote." He jangled as he sat back down. Lyle was about a decade younger than me, I guessed, and I couldn't figure if his look was intentionally ironic retro or just goofy. He started to apologize again, but I didn't want any more. I was full up, thanks. "Look, I'm not even saying I'm sold on the idea that Ben is innocent or that I made any mistakes in my testimony." He opened his mouth to say something, then snapped it back shut. "But if I were to look into it more, is that something the club would be able to help finance? pay for my time, in a way.
Wow, Libby, it's great news that you're even interested in looking into this, Lyle said. I hated this kid's tone, like he didn't realize he was talking to someone with seniority. He was the type who, when the class was over and kids were tapping toes and the teacher asked, "Any more questions?" actually had more questions.
I mean, the thing is, we all have theories about this case, but so many more doors would open for you than for anyone else, Lyle said, his leg jittering under the table. I mean, people actually want to talk to you.
Right. I pointed at the pitcher of beer Lyle had next to him, and he poured some into a plastic cup for me, mostly foam. Then he actually swiped his finger against his nose and put it in the beer. Oil flattened the foam and poured more.
So, what kind of compensation were you thinking?
He handed me the cup, and I set it in front of me, debating whether to drink it.
I think it would have to be case by case, I said, pretending I was just thinking of this for the first time. Depending on how hard it was to find the person and what questions you'd want me to ask.
Well, I think we'd have a long list of people we'd want you to talk to. Do you really have no contact with Runner? It's Runner that would be tops on most lists.
Good old fucked-in-the-head Runner. He'd called me once in the past 3 years, mumbling crazily into the phone, crying in a wee-hee shudder, and asking me to wire him money. Nothing since. Hell, not much before, either. He'd shown up sporadically at Ben's trial, sometimes in an old tie and jacket, mostly in whatever he slept in, so drunk he listed. He was finally asked by Ben's defense to stop coming. It looked bad. Now it looked even worse, with everyone in the Kill Club saying they believed he was the murderer. He'd been in jail 3 times I knew of, before the killings, but just podunk crap. Still, the guy always had gambling debts. Runner bet on everything. Sports, dog races, bingo, the weather. And he owed my mom child support. Killing us all would be a good way to be quit of that obligation.
But I couldn't picture Runner getting away with it. He wasn't smart enough, and definitely not ambitious enough. He couldn't even be a dad to his lone surviving child. He'd slunk around Kinnicky for a few years after the murders, sneaking away for a few months at a time, sending me duct-taped boxes from Idaho or Alabama or Winter, South Dakota. Inside would be truck-stop figurines of little girls with big eyes holding umbrellas or kittens that were always broken by the time they reached me. I'd know he was back in town, not because he came to visit me, but because he'd light that stinky fire in the cabin up on the ridge. Diane would sing, "Poor Judd is dead," when she saw him in town, face smudged with smoke. There was something both pitiful and frightening about him. It was probably a blessing he chose to avoid me. When he'd come back to live with my mom and us, that last summer before the end, all he did was tease me. At first it was leering, "Got your nose," sort of stuff. And then it was just mean. He came home from fishing one day, clomping through the house with his big, wet waders, banging on the door to the bathroom when I was in the tub, just screwing with me.
"Come on, open up. I got a surprise for you."
He finally flung the door wide, his beer odor busting in with him. He had something bundled in his arms, and then he flung them wide, threw a live 2-foot catfish in the water with me. It was the pointlessness that frightened me. I tried to scrabble out of the tub, the fish's slimy skin sliding over my flesh, its whiskered mouth gaping, prehistoric. I could have put my foot in that mouth, and the fish would have slid all the way up, tight like a boot. I flopped over the side of the tub, panting on the rug, Runner screaming at me to stop my damn baby crying.
"Every single one of my kids is a scared-ass dumb shit."
We couldn't clean ourselves for 3 days because Runner was too tired to kill the thing. I guess I get my laziness from him. I never know where Runner's at. Last I heard, he was somewhere in Arkansas. But that was a year ago,
at least.
Well, it might be a good idea to try to track him down. Some people would definitely want you to talk to him.
Although, I don't think Runner did it,
Lyle said.
It maybe makes the most sense. Debts, history of violence.
Craziness.
Craziness.
Lyle smiled pertly.
But he doesn't seem smart enough to pull that off. No offense.
None taken. So then, what's your theory?
I'm not quite ready to share that yet.
He patted a stack of file folders next to him.
I'll let you read through the pertinent facts of the case first.
Oh, for the love of Pete, I said, realizing as my lips were pressed into the P that it was my mother's phrase.
For the love of Pete, let's skedaddle. Where are my ding-dang keys? So if Ben's really innocent, why doesn't he try to get out? I asked. My voice went high, urgent on this last part, a child's whinny. But why can't I have dessert? I realized I was stealthily hoping Ben was innocent, that he'd be returned to me, the Ben I knew, before I was afraid of him. I had allowed myself a dangerous glimpse of him out of prison, striding up to my house, hands in his pockets. Another memory that came back once I let myself start thinking again. Ben with his hands always burrowed deep in his pockets, perpetually abashed. Ben sitting at my dinner table, if I had a dinner table, happy, forgiving, no harm done. If he was innocent.
If ifs and buts were candies and nuts, we'd all have a very Merry Christmas, I heard my Aunt Diane boom in my head.
Those words had been the bane of my childhood. A constant reminder that nothing turned out right. Not just for me, but for anyone. And that's why someone had invented a saying like that. So we'd all know that we'd never have what we needed. Because remember, remember, remember baby day. Ben was home that night. When I got out of bed to go to my mom's room, I saw his closed door with the light under it, murmuring from inside. He was there.
Maybe you could ask him. Make that your first stop. Go see Ben.
Ben in prison. I'd spent the last 20-odd years refusing to imagine the place. Now I pictured my brother in there, behind the wire, behind the concrete, down a gray slate hall, inside a cell. Did he have photos of the family anywhere? Would he even be allowed such a thing? I realized again I knew nothing about Ben's life. I didn't even know what a cell looked like, aside from what I'd seen in the movies. No, not Ben. Not yet.
Is it a money thing? We'd pay you for that.
It's a lot of things thing, I grumbled.
Okay, you want to look into Runner then, or what?
We sat silent. Neither of us knew what to do with our hands. We couldn't keep eye contact. As a child, I was constantly being sent on play dates with other kids. The shrinks insisted I interact with cohorts. That's what my meeting with Lyle was like. Those first, loose, horrible 10 minutes when the grown-ups have left. And neither kid knows what the other one wants, so you stand there, near the TV they've told you to keep off, fiddling with the antenna. I picked through the complimentary bowl of peanuts in their shells, brittle and airy as beetle husks. I dropped a few in my beer to get the salt. I poked at them. They bobbed. My whole scheme seemed remarkably childish. Was I really going to talk to people who might have killed my family? Was I really going to try to solve something? In any way but wishful thinking, could I believe Ben was innocent? And if he was innocent, didn't that make me the biggest bastard in history? I had that overwhelming feeling I get when I'm about to give up on a plan. That big rush of air when I realize that my stroke of genius has flaws, and I don't have the brains or energy to fix them.
It wasn't an option to go back to bed and forget the whole thing. I had rent coming up, and I'd need money for food soon. I could go on welfare, but that would mean figuring out how to go on welfare, and I'd probably sooner starve than deal with the paperwork.
"I'll go talk to Ben," I mumbled. "I should start there. But I'd need $300.
I said it thinking I wouldn't really get it. But Lyle reached into an old nylon wallet held together with duct tape and counted out $300. He didn't look unhappy.
"Where you get all this money from, Lyle?"
He beefed up a bit at that, sat straighter in his chair.
"I'm treasurer of the Kill Club. I have a certain amount of discretionary funds. This is the project I choose to use them for."
Lyle's tiny ears turned red, like angry embryos.
"You're embezzling."
I suddenly liked him more.
Ben Day, January 2, 1985, 10:18 a.m. It was an hour bike ride from the farm to Kennecke proper. At least an hour, at a good pace when the cold wasn't turning your lungs metal red and blood wasn't dripping down your cheek. Ben planned his work at the school for the times when it was most empty, like he'd never go there on a Saturday because the wrestling team had the gym on Saturdays. It was just too lame holding a mop when all these blocky, muscled, loud guys were waddling around, spitting chaw on the floor you just cleaned, and then looking at you, half guilty, half daring you to say something. Today was Wednesday, but it was still Christmas break, so the place should be kind of quiet. Well, the weight room was always busy, always making that sound like a thumping steel heart. But it was early. Early was always best. He usually went from 8 to noon, mopped and straightened and shined like the fucking monkey he was, and got the hell out before anyone saw him. Sometimes Ben felt like a fairy tale elf who'd creep in and leave everything spotless without anyone noticing. The kids here didn't give a shit about keeping things clean. They'd toss a carton toward a trash can, the milk drooling all over the floor, and just shrug. They'd spill sloppy Joe meat on their cafeteria seat and just leave it there, hardening for someone else to deal with. Ben did it too, just because that's what everyone did. He'd actually drop a glob of tuna sandwich on the floor and roll his eyes like it wasn't worth dealing with when he was the guy who'd be dealing with it in a few days. It was the stupidest thing. He was actually abusing himself. So it sucked to deal with this shit at any point, and it was even worse to deal with it when other kids were around, trying to avoid seeing him. Today, though, he'd take his chances, go ahead and put in his shift. Deandra was driving into Selena for the morning to shop. The girl had at least 20 pairs of jeans, all of them looking the same to Ben, and she needed more, some special brand. She wore them baggy, rolled the cuffs tight at her ankle with those bulky socks peeking out. He always made sure he complimented the new jeans, and Deandra would then immediately say, "But what about the socks?" It was a joke, but not really. Deandra wore only Ralph Lauren socks. They cost like $20 a pair, a fact that turned Ben's stomach. She had an entire dresser filled with socks, argyle and polka dotted and striped, all with the horseman at the top, mid-swing. Ben had done the math. Must be $400 of socks in that drawer, sitting there like a bin of Florida fruits, worth probably half what his mom made in a month. Well, rich people need stuff to buy, and socks are probably as good as anything. Deandra was a strange one, not really preppy. She was too flashy and wild to fit in that crowd, but not entirely in the metal crowd either, even though she blared Iron Maiden and loved leather and smoked tons of weed. Deandra wasn't in any clique. She was just the new girl. Everyone knew her, but didn't at the same time. She'd lived all over, a lot of it in Texas, And her standard line, whenever she did anything you might want to frown on, was, "That's how they do it in Texas." No matter what she did, it was okay, because that's how they did it in Texas. Before Deandra, Ben had just floated. He'd been a poor, quiet farm boy who hung out with other farm kids in an unnoticed corner of the school. They weren't dorky enough to be actually reviled. They were never picked on. They were the background noise of high school. To him, that was worse than being humiliated. Well, maybe not. There was this guy with big bifocals, a kid Ben knew since kindergarten who'd always been weird. The kid crapped his pants the first week of high school. The stories varied how. One had him dropping bundles of shit out his shorts while he climbed the rope in gym. Another had him losing a load in homeroom. There were third and fourth and fifth versions. The main point was, he was forever branded shit shorts. He kept his head down between classes, those moon-sized glasses aimed at the floor, and still some jock would slap him in the head. "Hey, shit shorts!" He'd just keep walking, his face in this grim smile, like he was pretending to be in on the joke. So yeah, there were worse things than being unnoticed, but Ben hadn't liked it, didn't want to be the same nice, quiet, red-headed kid he'd been since first grade. Dickless and boring. Big fucking thanks then to Deandra for claiming him, at least in private. She'd actually hit him with her car. That's how they met. It was summer, orientation for freshmen and new kids. It was a crummy 3 hours, and after, as he was walking across the school parking lot, she'd plowed into him, knocked him right up on her hood. She'd gotten out, screaming at him, "What the fuck is fucking wrong with you?" Her breath smelling of wine cooler, the bottles clinking in the footwell of her CRX. When Ben apologized, he apologized to her, and Deandra realized he wasn't going to get angry at her, she got real sweet. She offered to give him a ride home, and instead they drove to the outside of town and parked and drank more wine coolers. Deandra said her name was Alexis, but after a little bit, she told him she'd lied. It was Deandra. Ben told her she should never lie about a cool name like that, and it made her happy, and after a little bit longer, Deandra said, "You know what? You have a really nice face." And then a few seconds later, she said, "You want a scam or what?" And then they were full-on making out, which wasn't his first time, but was only his second. After an hour, Deandra had to go. But she said he was a great listener. It was really cool how great a listener he was. She didn't have time to drive him home after all. She dropped him off right back where she'd hit him. So they started dating. Ben didn't really know her friends, and he didn't ever hang out with her at school. Deandra darted in and out of the school week like a hummingbird. Sometimes she'd show up, sometimes not. It was enough to see her on the weekends, in their own space where school didn't matter. Being with her had rubbed off on him. He was just more there. By the time Ben pedaled into Kinnicky, a cluster of pickup trucks and beat-up sports cars sat in the school parking lot. So, basketball players as well as wrestlers. He knew who drove each car. He thought about ducking out, but Deandra wouldn't be home for hours, and he didn't have enough money to linger at the hamburger joint. The owner was red-faced crazy about kids hanging out there without buying something. Plus, sitting by yourself at a diner during Christmas break was worse than actually working. Fuck his mom for being such a stress case. Deandra's mom and dad didn't care what she did. They were out of town half the time at their place in Texas. Even when Deandra was busted for missing 2 whole weeks of school last month, her mom had just laughed. "When the cat's away, huh, sweetie? At least try to do some homework." The back entrance to the school was chained shut, so he had to go in through the locker rooms. The smell of flesh and foot spray hit him as he entered. The overhead thunk of the basketball court and clank of the weight room reassured him that the locker room, at least, would be empty. Outside in the hallway, he heard a single long yell.
"Cooper! Hold up!"
echo against the marble floor like a battle cry. Tennis shoes slapped down the hall, a metal door banged open, and then everything was relatively quiet. Just gym and weight room noise. Thunk, thunk, clank, thunk. The school's athletes had this trust thing, a sign of teamwork, that they never put locks on their lockers. Instead, they all tied thick shoestrings through the loops where a lock would go. At least 12 white strings hung on the lockers, and Ben wavered as usual about looking inside one. What the hell did these guys need anyway? If you had school lockers for books, what would go in these gym bins? Were there deodorants or lotions, some kind of underclothes that he was missing? Did they all wear the same kind of jock strap? Thunk, thunk, clank, thunk. One shoelace hung limply, unknotted. Just a quick yank and the locker would open. Before he could talk himself out of it, he pulled off the lace and gently, quietly, lifted the metal latch. Inside the locker was nothing of interest. Some gym shorts crumpled at the bottom, a rolled-up sports magazine, a gym bag hanging loosely from a hook. The bag looked like it contained a few objects, so Ben leaned in and unzipped it.
"Hey!"
He turned around, the bag swaying wildly on the hook and falling to the bottom of the locker. Mr. Gruger, the wrestling coach, was standing with a newspaper in his hand, his rough, splotchy face twisted up.
"What the hell do you think you're doing in that locker?"
It was open.
"What?"
I saw it was open," Ben said.
He shut it as quietly as he could.
"Please, fuck, 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 just not let any of the team come back in," Ben thought.
He could picture all the angry faces aimed at him, the nicknames to come.
"It was open? Why were you in it?"
Gruger let the question hang there, didn't move, didn't give any clue what he was going to do, what level of trouble this was. Ben tried just staring at the floor, waiting to be chastened.
"I said, why were you in that locker?"
Gruger smacked the newspaper against his fat hand.
"I don't know."
The old man just kept standing there, Ben thinking all the while, "Just yell and get it done with."
"Were you going to take something?"
"No."
"Then why were you in it?"
"I was just..."
Ben trailed off again.
"I thought I saw something."
"You thought you saw something? What?"
Ben's mind flashed on things forbidden. Pets, drugs, titty magazines. He pictured firecrackers, and he thought for a second he'd say the locker was on fire. Be a hero.
Matches?
"You thought you saw matches?"
The blood in Gruger's face had moved from his cheeks straight up to the flesh beneath his fuzzy crew cut.
"I wanted a cigarette."
"You're the janitor boy, right? Something Day?"
Gruger made the name sound silly, girlish. The coach's eyes examined the cut on Ben's forehead, then marched pointedly up to his hair.
"You dyed your hair."
Ben stood under his thatch of black and felt himself being categorized and discarded, sectioned off into a group of losers, druggies, wimps, fags. He was sure he heard that word snarl into the coach's mind. Gruger's upper lip twitched.
"Get out of here. Go clean somewhere else. Don't come back in here till we're gone. You are not welcome here. You understand?"
Ben nodded.
"Why don't you say it out loud, just so we're clear?"
"I'm not welcome here," Ben mumbled.
"Now go."
He said it like Ben was a boy, a 5-year-old being sent back to his mother. Ben went. Up the stairwell to the janitor's dank closet, a droplet of sweat dripping down his back. Ben wasn't breathing. He forgot to breathe when he was this angry. He got out the industrial-sized bucket and rattled it into the sink, ran hot water into it, poured in the piss-colored cleaning mixture, ammonia fumes burning his eyes. Then heaved it back into the wheel frame. He'd filled the bucket too heavy. It tipped as he tried to get it over the edge of the sink, sloshing a half gallon of water down his front. His crotch and leg were nice and soaked. Looked like he wet himself. Janitor boy day. The jeans stuck to his thighs, turned rigid. He'd have 3 hours of shitty grunt work with a wet crotch and jeans like cardboard. "Fuck you, fucker," he muttered quietly. He kicked the wall with a work boot, spraying plaster, and smashed the wall with a hand.
"Fuck!"
he bellowed, his voice going high at the end. He waited in the closet like a coward, worrying that Gruger would track the scream and decide to screw with him some more. Nothing happened. No one was interested enough to see what was going on in the janitorial closet. He was supposed to have cleaned a week earlier, but Deandra had whined it was officially Christmas break. Leave it. So the cafeteria trash was filled with old soda cans dripping syrup, sandwich wrappers covered in chicken salad, and moldy helpings of 1984's final lunch special, a hamburger casserole with sweet tomato sauce. All of it rotten. He got a little bit of everything on his sweater and jeans, so in addition to ammonia and B.O., he smelled like old food. He couldn't go to Deandra's like this. He was an idiot to have planned it like this in the first place. He'd have to bike home, deal with his mom, that was a 30-minute lecture right there, shower, and bike back over to her place. If his mom didn't ground him, screw it, he'd still leave. It was his body, his hair. His fucked-up, faggoty black hair. He mopped the floors, then bagged the trash in all the teachers' rooms, his favorite chore because it sounded big, but amounted to gathering bunches of crumpled paper, light as leaves. His final duty was to mop down the hall that connected the high school to the grade school, which had its own embarrassed student janitor. The hallway was papered with loud notices about football and track and drama club on the high school side, and then slowly disintegrated into children's territory, the walls covered with letters of the alphabet and book reports on George Washington. Bright blue doors marked the grade school entrance, but they were ceremonial. They didn't even have locks. He mopped his way from high school land to Kittyville and dropped the mop into the bucket, kicked the whole thing away from him. The bucket rolled smoothly across the concrete floor and hit the wall with a modest splash. From kindergarten through eighth grade, he'd gone to Kennecke Grade School. He had more connection with that side of the building than the high school side where he stood now. Pieces of its refuse stuck to him. He thought about opening the door, wandering through the silence on the other side, and then that's what he was doing. Just saying hi to the old place. Ben heard the door shut behind him and felt more relaxed. The walls here were lemon yellow, with more decorations outside each classroom. Kennecke was small enough that each grade was just one class. The high school was different, twice as big because other towns funneled their teens in. But the grade school was always nice and cozy. On the wall, he spotted a smiley felt sunshine, Michelle D., age 10, written along one side. And here was a drawing of a cat in a vest with buckle shoes, or maybe they were high heels. Anyway, it was smiling and handing a present to a mouse who was holding a birthday cake. Libby D., grade 1. He looked but saw nothing from Debbie. He wasn't sure the kid could draw, come to think of it. She tried to help his mom bake cookies one time, breathing loudly and botching the recipe, then eating more of the dough than she cooked. Debbie was not the kind of kid who had anything put up on the wall. All along the hallway were rows of yellow bins, where the students were allowed to keep personal items, each kid's name written on masking tape on their bin. He looked in Libby's and found a peppermint candy, partially sucked, and a paperclip. Debbie's had a brown lunch sack that stank of bologna. Michelle's, a pack of dried-up markers. He looked in a few others just for kicks, and realized how much more stuff they had. 64 Crayola crayon box sets, battery-operated toy cars and dolls, thick reams of construction paper, keychains and sticker books and bags of candy. Sad. That's what you get when you have more kids than you can take care of, he thought. It was what Deandra always said when he mentioned tight times at home. Well, your mom shouldn't have had so many babies then. Deandra was an only child. Ben started back toward the high school side and caught himself scanning the fifth grade bins. There she was, the little girl Chrissy with the crush on him. She'd written her name in bright green letters and drawn a daisy next to it. Cute. The girl was the definition of cute, like something on a cereal commercial, blonde hair, blue eyes, and just well taken care of. Unlike his sisters, her jeans always fit and were clean and ironed. Her shirts matched the color of her socks, or barrettes, or whatever. She didn't have food breath like Debbie, or scrapes all over her hands like Libby. Like all of them. Her fingernails were always painted bright pink. You could tell her mom did them for her. He bet her bin was filled with strawberry shortcake dolls and other toys that smelled good. Even her name was right. Chrissy Cates was just a naturally cool name. By high school, she'd be a cheerleader, that long blonde hair down her back, and she'd probably forget she ever went crazy over this older boy named Ben. He'd be what then, 20? Maybe drive in with Deandra from Wichita for a game, and she'd look over mid-bounce and see him break into a big white smile, do a little excited wave, and Deandra would do her hee-haw laugh and say, "Isn't it enough that half the women in Wichita are in love with you? You gotta pick on poor little high school girls, too?" Ben might never have met Chrissy. She was a grade above Michelle. But he got recruited one day at the beginning of the school year. Mrs. Nagel, who always liked him, grabbed Ben to help monitor the after-school art class. Just for the day. Her usual monitor hadn't shown up. He'd been due back home, but knew his mom couldn't get pissed at him helping with the little ones. She was always on him to help with the little ones at home. And mixing paint was a hell of a lot more inviting than hauling manure. Chrissy was one of his kids, but she didn't seem that interested in painting. She just moved the stuff around with her brush until her whole paper turned shit brown. "You know what that looks like?" he'd said. "Poop," she said, and started laughing. She was flirty, even for a kid. You could tell she was born cute and just assumed people would like her. Well, he did. They talked between long, flat lines of silence. "So, where do you live?" Pour, slap, swipe. Dip the brush in the water and repeat. "Near Selena." "And you come all the way out here for school?" "They haven't finished my school yet. Next year, I'll go near home." "That's a long drive." Squeak of a seat, slump of a shoulder. "Yep, I hate it. I have to wait hours after school for my dad to get me." "Well, art's good." "I guess. I like ballet more. That's what I do on weekends." Ballet on weekends said a lot. She probably was one of those kids with a pool in the backyard, or if not a pool, a trampoline. He thought about telling her they had cows at his house, see if she liked animals, but felt like he was already too eager with her. She was a kid. She should be the one trying to impress. He volunteered the rest of that month in art, teasing Chrissy about her bad drawings. "What's this supposed to be, a turtle?" And letting her go on about ballet. "No, you big goof, it's my dad's BMW. One day, Gutsy Girl, she snuck over to the high school side of the building and was waiting at his locker in jeans with sequin butterflies on the pocket and a pink shirt that poked out in gumdrop lumps where her breasts would be. No one was bothering her, except for one maternal girl who tried to mother her back to the right side of the building.
"I'm okay,"
she told her, flipping her hair, and turned to Ben.
"I just wanted to give you this."
She handed him a note, folded into the shape of a triangle, with his name written in bubble letters on the front. Then she pranced away, half the size of most of the kids around her, but not looking like she noticed.
"Once I was in art class and met a boy named Ben. It was his heart I knew I would win. He has red hair and really nice skin. Are you in?"
At the bottom was a big L with Onger, Etter, Ater written alongside it. He'd seen friends of friends with notes like these, but hardly ever got them himself. Last February, he got three Valentines, one from the teacher, because she had to, one from the nice girl who gave everybody one, and one from the urgent fat girl who always seemed on the edge of crying. Deandra wrote him now sometimes, but the notes weren't cute. They were dirty or angry, stuff she scrawled in detention. No girl had ever done a poem for him, and it was even cuter that she seemed to have no idea he was way too old for her. It was a love poem from a girl who had no idea about sex or making out. Or did she? When did normal kids start making out? The next day, she waited for him outside art class and asked him if he'd sit in the stairwell with her, and he said, okay, but just for a second, and they joked around for a whole hour on those shadowy stairs. At one point, she grabbed his arm and leaned into him, and he knew he should tell her not to, but it felt so sweet and not at all weird and just nice, not like Deandra's sex-crazed scratching and yelling or his sister's poking and roughhousing, but sweet, the way a girl should be. She wore lip gloss that smelled like bubblegum, and since Ben never had enough money for bubblegum, how fucked up was that? It always made his mouth water. So they'd gone on like that for the last few months, sitting in the stairwell, waiting for her dad. They never talked on the weekends, and sometimes she even forgot to wait for him, and he'd be standing in the stairwell like a dick holding a packet of warm Skittles he'd found cleaning the cafeteria. Chrissy loved sweet things. His sisters were the same way. They scrounged for sugar like beetles. He came home one time to find Libby eating jelly straight out of the jar. Deandra never knew about the thing with Chrissy. When Deandra did come to school, she beat it straight home at 3:16 to watch her soaps and Donahue. She usually did this while eating cake batter straight from the mixing bowl. What was it with girls and sugar? And even if Deandra did know, there was nothing wrong going on. He was like a guidance counselor in a way. An older guy advising a girl on homework and high school. Maybe he should go into psychology or be a teacher. His dad was 5 years older than his mom. The only iffy thing with him and Chrissy happened just before Christmas and wouldn't happen again. They were sitting in the stairwell, sucking on green apple Jolly Ranchers and jostling each other, and suddenly she was much closer than usual, a small nudge of nipple on his arm. The apple smell was hot on his neck, and she just clung there against him, not saying anything, just breathing, and he could feel her heartbeat like a kitten on his bicep, and her fingers squirm up near his armpits, and suddenly her lips were right there on his ear, that breath turning his ear wet, his gums twitching from the tartness of the candy, and then the lips were trailing down his cheek, sending chills down his arms, and neither of them acknowledging what was going on, and then her face was in front of his, and those little lips pushing against his, not really moving, and the two of them just staying there with identical beating hearts, her entire body now fitted between his legs, and his hands kept rigidly down by his sides, gone all sweaty, and then a small moving of his lips, just a little opening, and her tongue was there, sticky and lapping, and them both tasting of green apple, and his dick got so hard he thought it might explode in his pants, and he put his hands on her waist and held her for a second and moved her off him and ran down the stairwell to the boys' bathroom, yelling, "Sorry, sorry," behind him, and he made it into a stall just in time to jerk twice and come all over his hands.
Libby Day, now. So I was going to meet my brother, all grown up. After my beer with Lyle, I actually went home and looked at Barb Eichel's copy of Your Prison Family, Get Past the Bars. After reading a few confusing chapters about the administration of the Florida State Penitentiary System, I flipped back through the foxed pages to the copyright, 1985. How not remotely useful. I worried about receiving more pointless bundles from Barb, pamphlets about defunct Alabama waterslide parks, brochures about smithereened Las Vegas hotels, warnings about the Y2K bug. I ended up making Lyle handle all the arrangements. I told him I couldn't get through to the right person, was overwhelmed by it all. But the truth was, I just didn't want to. I don't have the stamina. Press numbers, wait on hold, talk, wait on hold, then be real nice to some pissed-off woman with three kids and annual resolutions to go back to college. Some woman just wiggling with the hope you'll give her an excuse to pull the plug on you. She's a bitch, all right, but you can't call her that, or all of a sudden there you are, shoots and laddered back to the beginning. And that's supposed to make you nicer when you phone back. Let Lyle deal with it. Ben's prison is right outside Kinnickey and was built in 1997 after another round of farm consolidations. Kinnickey is almost in the middle of Kansas, not so far from the Nebraska border, and it once claimed to be the geographic center of the 48 contiguous United States, the heart of America. It was a big deal back in the 80s when we were all patriotic. Other cities in Kansas made a grab for the title, but Kinnickeyans ignored them, stubbornly, proudly. It was the city's only point of interest. The Chamber of Commerce sold posters and T-shirts with the town's name cursived inside a heart. Every year, Diane bought all us girls a new shirt, partly because we liked anything heart-shaped, and partly because Kinnickey is an old Indian word, which means magical little woman. Diane always tried to get us to be feminists. My mother joked that she didn't shave much, and that was a start. I don't remember her saying it, but I remember Diane, broad and angry, as she always was after the murders, smoking a cigarette in her trailer, drinking iced tea out of a plastic cup with her name written in log cabin letters on the side, telling me the story. Turns out we were wrong after all. Lebanon, Kansas, is the official center of the United States. Kinnickey was working from bad information. I'd thought I'd have months before I got permission to see Ben, but it seems the Kinnickey, Kansas State Penitentiary is quick with the visitor passes. It's our belief that interaction with family and friends is a beneficial activity for inmates, helping them stay socialized and connected. Paperwork and bullshit. And then I spent the few intervening days going over Lyle's files, reading the transcript of Ben's trial, which I'd never mustered enough courage to do. It made me sweat. My testimony was a zigzag of confusing kid memories. "I think Ben brought a witch to the house and she killed us," I said, to which the prosecutor replied only, "Now let's talk about what really happened." And overly coached dialogue. "I saw Ben as I was standing on the edge of my mom's room. He was threatening my mom with our shotgun." As for Ben's defense attorney, he might as well have wrapped me in tissue paper and set me on a feather bed, he was so delicate with me. "Might you be a little confused about what you saw, Libby? Are you positive? Positive it was your brother, Libby? Are you maybe telling us what you think we want to hear?" To which I replied, "No. Yes. No." By the end of the day, I answered, "I guess," to every single question.
my way of saying I was done. Ben's defense attorney had hammered at that bit of blood on Michelle's bedspread and the mysterious dress shoe that left a print in my family's blood, but couldn't come up with a convincing alternate theory. Maybe someone else had been there, but there were no footprints, no tire treads outside the house to prove it. The morning of January 3rd brought a 20-degree bump in the temperature, melting the snow and all its imprints to a spring-like mush. Besides my testimony, Ben had weighing against him fingernail scratches across his face he couldn't explain, a story about a bushy-haired man he initially claimed killed everyone, a story he quickly exchanged for the out-all-night-don't-know-nothing defense, a large chunk of Michelle's hair found on the floor of his room, and his general crazy demeanor that day. He'd dyed his hair black, which everyone deemed suspicious. He'd been spotted sneaking around school, several teachers testified. They wondered if he was perhaps trying to retrieve some of the animal remains that he'd kept in his locker. Animal remains? Or if he was gathering other students' personal items for a satanic mass. Later in the day, he apparently went to some stoner hangout and bragged about his devil sacrifices. Ben didn't help himself, either. He had no alibi for the murders. He had a key to the house, which had not been broken into. He'd had a fight with my mother that morning. Also, he was kind of a shit. As the prosecutors proclaimed that he was a Satan-worshipping killer, Ben responded by enthusiastically discussing the rituals of devil worship, particular songs he liked that reminded him of the underworld and the great power of Satanism. It encourages you to do what feels good, because we are all basically animals. At one point, the prosecutor asked Ben to stop playing with your hair and get serious. Do you understand this is serious? I understand you think it's serious, Ben replied. It didn't even sound like the Ben I remembered, the quiet, bundled brother of mine. Lyle had included a few news photos from the trial. Ben with his black hair and a ponytail. Why didn't his lawyers make him cut it? Wedged into a lopsided suit, always either smirking or completely effectless. So Ben didn't help himself, but the trial transcript made me blush. Then again, the whole thing left me feeling a little better. It wasn't all my fault Ben was in jail, if he was truly innocent, if he truly was. No, it was a little bit of everybody's fault. A week after agreeing to meet Ben, I was meeting Ben. I was driving back toward my hometown, where I hadn't been in at least 12 years, which had turned itself into a prison town without my permission. The whole thing was too quick. It gave me emotional bends. The only way I could get in the car was to keep reassuring myself I would not go into Kinnicky proper, and I would not go down that long dirt road that would take me home. No, I would not. Not that it was my home anymore. Someone had bought the property years ago, razed the house immediately, crushing walls my mother had prettied with cheap, flowery posters, smashing windows we'd breathed against while waiting to see who was coming down the drive, splintering the door frame where my mom had penciled the growth of Ben and my sisters, but been too tired to chart me. I had just one entry, Libby, 3 feet 2 inches. I drove 3 hours into Kansas, rolling up and down the Flint Hills, then hitting the flatlands, signs inviting me to visit the Greyhound Hall of Fame, the Museum of Telephony, the largest ball of twine. Again, a burst of loyalty. I should go to them all, if only to smack ironic road trippers. I finally turned off the highway, heading north and west and north and west on jigsaw back roads, the farm fields dots of green and yellow and brown, pastoral pointillism. I huddled over the wheel, flipping stations between weepy country tunes and Christian rock and fuzz. The struggling March sun managed to warm the car, blazed my grotesque red hairline. The warmth and the color made me think again of blood. In the passenger seat next to me was a single airplane bottle of vodka I planned to swallow when I got to the prison, a self-prescribed dose of numbness.
It took an uncharacteristic amount of willpower not to gulp it on the drive, one hand on the wheel, throat tilted back. Like a magic trick, just as I was thinking, getting close now,